Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in. A good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast.
Hello and welcome to this very special event tonight. My name is Frances Foley. I'm Deputy Director here at Compass. And this is a kind of new series that we are putting on, which we have coordinated with one of our co-chairs, Barry. I'd like to give a shout out to Barry Knight, who has suggested this series and helped bring these brilliant panelists into the room to talk to us tonight. The title of tonight's session is What's the Point, Miss? And we're talking about the state of education here in the UK. And also, we will later on talk about the solution. So for those of you who worried that tonight might be quite depressing, I have been assured by the speakers that despite the possible depressing state of some of education here in the UK, we will also give grounds for optimism and hope and point to some of the solutions and alternatives that we might be focused on. So just a little bit of housekeeping for those of you who are new to kind of Compass seminars and webinars. We will keep the session sort of more or less half and half. We've got a big panel of speakers here tonight, so we're going to give them ample time, and they've got some brilliant presentations and ideas to share with you. But we will also definitely have time for questions later in the session. So firstly, as ever, I'd love you to make use of the chat. Please just go in the chat, say where you're from, say why you joined here tonight, maybe a bit about your background or things that are buzzing around in your head. We'd just love to just hear who's on the call tonight. So please introduce yourselves in the chat. Next to the chat at the bottom of your screen, you'll see the Q&A function. You can use that to start loading up questions in the Q&A as soon as you want, really. If you come with a burning question here tonight that you want the speakers to address, you can get stuck in there early. And I would like to say, little tip is that you can obviously vote up other people's questions. And if you get your question in early, there's a higher chance that you will get outvoted because people see it, more people see it. So that's a little a pointer for you. When we come to your questions, I've been asked by Gabriel to just note that because we've got a bunch of presentations tonight and they're quite a full panel, you may be just be asked to speak. So if you do ask a question, prepare to be asked to speak. Don't worry if you then can't or have to step off the call, we will help you with that. And just to say, tonight's session, as ever, will be recorded, so it can be watched back by people who couldn't make it here this evening, and so they can fully take in and digest all that we talk about tonight. So that was the boring stuff, housekeeping stuff over with. I wanted to say one line just about also why this is important to us here at Compass. So many of you might be familiar with the work of Compass in other parts of what we do. So some of you will be familiar with our work on progressive alliance building. I work on building a kind of shape and helping shape the future of the next progressive majority government, which we do quite a lot of work on as well. And we really see those two lines of our work in parallel. So we do a lot of work that's kind of tactical and strategic and getting the vote out and getting parties to be connected to one another and amplifying the progressive vote across the country. But we also think it's really connected to always be linked back to this question of why. The question of values, and most importantly, to the kind of idea, which was one of the founding ideas of Compass, which is around a good society. So we're doing all of this for a purpose, and whatever we do on the sort of more pragmatic and practical side of things, we always make sure that it feels sort of principled as well. And so this series is really close to our heart, and this question of education has been a large part of what Compass has focused on in the past. And quite a few years ago now, we ran a big series, seminar series, and also wrote a big report around the idea of big education. And I'll drop some links to that later in the chat. Some of you might have been involved with that. And that was really throwing open this idea of what is education for, which is an idea that's central to the discussion of tonight and central to all of what we do here at Compass. So you see education as being foundational to the good society and to every other aspect of the things we're campaigning on, whether it's social care or climate or inequality or democracy. So that's probably quite enough from me. I'm just here to kind of loosely facilitate and actually learn quite a lot from our speakers tonight. I'm certainly no expert in education. And so without further ado, I'm going to introduce the panel. So first speaking tonight, we have Peter Moss. Peter is Emeritus Professor at the UCL Institute for Education, and he's a specialist in early child education. Then following Peter, who's going to kick us off with an introduction, we'll have Robin Duckett. Robin is Director of Sightlines, which is an advocacy organisation for early childhood education. He'll be speaking alongside Chris Merrick. Chris is a former head teacher and inspector, and she's also been working with Sightlines for over 20 years. And then also we'll hear from Madeline Holt, who's an education campaigner with Rescue Our Schools and also a filmmaker for Schools on Screen. So I'm kind of slightly overawed by the expertise and actually also experience of everybody here on the panel. And hopefully they'll give us a sense of where we are at right now with some view to the context of where we've come from, which I think is really helpful to talk about. So we're going to hear from Peter first, then Robin and Chris, and then Madeline. And then I promise we will leave ample time for discussions and questions. And please do get that going in the chat. I can see already the chat has become lively. And get your questions and answers loaded up as well. We'll finish by 7:30, and we'll probably move on to questions in around sort of 40 minutes. So do get those loaded up. And that's probably enough for me. So I'm going to pass over to Peter. Do you want to tell us why we're all here?
Thank you very much, Frances. This evening is the first of two sessions on education in this Compass series. This first session offers the bad news, I'm afraid, of what's gone so wrong in education in England over the last 30 years or so. While next month in May, we'll turn to those to open up discussion about alternatives, about how a better, richer, more relevant education is both necessary and possible. And I did emphasize, because actually we are going to focus on England, as you'll probably know, that in the UK, education is a devolved competence, and therefore there are substances between education in the four nations. Gabriel, could you bring up the shared screen, please? This session is in four parts. I'll begin by offering a framework for understanding what's happened and what's gone wrong in education in recent years. Then Chris and Robin will look in more detail at early childhood and primary education, followed by Madeline looking at secondary education. Then I'll wrap up the session arguing that today we are facing the consequences of a 35-year experiment in education that has failed. The advocates for that experiment have argued there is no alternative to what we have today, and they've poured scorn on those who have questioned them. But of course, there are alternatives. Next slide, please. So let me turn to what's been done in England in the last 35 years or so in education. And this is the story of how England has been at the centre of another pandemic germ. Next slide, please. Professor Stephen Ball from UCL's Institute of Education is one of the world's leading authorities on the recent history of education, both in England and globally. He has described how the English education in recent years has been, and I'm quoting from him here, a social laboratory of experimentation and reform. Policies like parental choice, information and accountability systems, contracting out education services, and public-private partnerships, all these are being exported around the world by English education businesses and policy entrepreneurs. These are the key features of what Pasi Sahlberg calls germ. And the Pasi Sahlberg that Stephen Ball refers to is an educator, an educationalist from Finland, and a leading scholar in the field. And he's also an originator of this term, germ. Next slide, please. So, what is germ? Germ stands for the Global Education Reform Movement, and it is the education wing of neoliberalism. It's got five main symptoms. First, market logic, the marketizing of education, with the creation of markets for and increased competition between nurseries and schools, but also increased competition between students and also between countries. Second, standardization with the centralized specification of performance standards for nurseries and schools, and again, thirdly, a focus on core subjects, in particular literacy, numeracy, and science, at the expense of many other subjects, leading inexorably to a narrowing of education. Fourth, corporate and business management models. These transform nurseries and schools to become, as Stephen Ball puts it, business-like and like a business. Now most nurseries and schools in England are privatized and subject to business management methods. And finally, test-based accountability, with governments controlling nurseries and schools at a distance through testing and management by numbers, or what has been called the datafication of education, in which children become a collection of numbers, the task of education being to steer these numbers in a certain direction. You will hear many examples of these symptoms tonight from Robin, Chris, and Madeleine. Next slide, please. GERM emerges on the coattails of neoliberalism in the 1980s, making its presence felt in England with the 1988 Education Reform Act. It has since spread to all sectors of education, from early childhood right through into universities and to many countries. Pasi Sahlberg offers a vivid image of this proliferation and its consequences. GERM, he's written, is like an epidemic that spreads and infects education systems through a virus. It travels with pundits, media, and politicians. Education systems borrow policies from others and get infected. As a consequence, schools get ill, teachers don't feel well, and kids learn less. But not only has GERM spread its symptoms through education, it's also caused education to shrivel, reducing it to a narrow economic purpose of increasing economic competitiveness and growth. As the historian of education, David Labarre, puts it, we have seen one goal for education trump the others. Nowadays, the uniform message is human capital, uber alles. Next slide, please. I can't end this introduction without mentioning last month's white paper from the English government. The white paper is basically more of the same, more GERM, with its focus on market logic and business models. There is constant reference to GERM language, such as standards, outcomes, inspections, reading, and maths. On the other hand, the white paper has nothing to say about many important educational matters, such as democracy, inequality and poverty, art, drama and creativity. The white paper's overriding aim is to finish the marketization and privatization of education in England by turning all schools into academies by 2030, completing the removal of schools from local authority oversight. This despite the fact there is no clear evidence this will improve education. Indeed, although the white paper makes much play at being based on evidence, it has been slated for a lack of honesty in its use of evidence in a withering critique by the educational journalist Warwick Mansell. He writes, as an education department presiding over a system which must surely encourage children to seek out truth, the white paper is just not good enough. Next slide, please. So to summarize this introduction, we can say that GERM is now endemic and chronic in English education from 0 to 18 and beyond, and that GERM has left English education in an unhealthy and diminished state, So now I'll pass over to Robin and Chris to drill down in more detail into how GERM has affected early childhood and primary education.
Thank you very much, Peter. So next slide, please, Gabriel. Well, we want to take you a little bit back because we're keen to introduce what's become fragile and shaken. Next slide, please. The beginning of the 1900s, and certainly by the 1920s, saw in England and across Britain quite a sparkiness in prospects for knowledge and thinking and practice for young children's support and education. And that was built on the thinking of many people, and some of whom we've galleried here. Frederick Froebel in the 1820s is still somebody who we lean on and first saw and talked about the child as worthy of being regarded as intelligence and with intelligence. We could go back further. And there are others that we lent on as well. Steiner in Germany. We want to focus a little bit on Susan Isaacs, because Susan Isaacs was one of several, mostly women, in the early 1900s, who began experiments in early childhood education. And there were others. There were the Macmillan sisters during the war. Susan Isaacs worked for some years at an experimental school. She was invited to begin in Cambridge, the Malthouse School. And they looked very much at ongoing understandings of predecessors, but also looking directly at children and learning from children. Their ideas of education, of all of these historical people, were that education was not primarily a matter of instruction towards passive recipients, but a matter of construction with intelligent human beings. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Robin. This is a picture of Susan Isaacs in the Malthouse School. And Susan Isaacs actually wrote The Educational Value of the Nursery School in 1954. And it was very much highlighting that learning for young children sprung from their real and active experience, their everyday problem solving and their search for answers. It was very much based in children's interests. And those of you out there who are involved in early childhood now will recognise some of those things. We still talk about the value of play. We still talk about children's interests being part of it. And she actually emphasised that it's the answers to their questions, the children's questions, that they learn from, rather than our questions. All of those pioneers working really meant that in the 1950s, we got a groundswell of new nursery classes. We had nursery classes in primary schools in those days. I started school in a nursery class at 3 in Yorkshire. But we also got a huge number of certainly far more than we've got now, but maintained nursery schools, because it was acknowledged that actually going to nursery school, children were able to learn more by socialising with other children, by exchanging ideas with other children, by being in the company and learning with others, than they would do just at home, playing at home. And so we got maintained nursery schools were opened, usually in disadvantaged areas, with a view to raising the quality of the learning in association with others. But whilst we had those maintained nurseries in disadvantaged areas, other areas had no access to them. And throughout the 1960s, 70s, 80s, actually women, mostly women, certainly being involved with the playgroup movement at that time, we were all women. And we decided to band together and do our own thing. we open playgroups. We open playgroups and they serve the community, and we organise them on the basis of serving the community as we needed to do it. They were run by parents. It was a democratic way of working. The committees organised the things, and we all had a say in what we did. Those playgroups still, there may be playgroup leaders out there now, they still have survived. But also alongside that, people, individuals opened private nurseries. Private nurseries that were no longer, not like the playgroups, which were not for profit, but had a business model to run them and were run on a business model. And increasingly, in more recent years, we've seen those become chains, big businesses. The biggest of them currently are Busy Bees and Bright Horizons, and between them across England, they actually have about 57,000 places on their books. And Kids Planet are coming up fast behind them. They have, I say fast behind them, they actually have 6,000. And even the YMCA now runs 73 nurseries and have 4,000 places amongst them for the children. And we've got these disparate ways of offering early childhood. We have a national funding system which funds per capita, but all those different settings, if we could have the next, that's the next one. Can we have the next one, Gabriel? Sorry, I forgot to ask this one. Just to go back, because this is quite an important slide. Now, the idea that the aim of education is to create people who are not only self-disciplined and free in spirit and gifted in work and enjoyment, but worthy and desirable as persons, responsible and generous in social life, and able to give and take freely from others, willing to serve social ends and to lose themselves in social purposes greater than themselves. What more could you wish for from education, really and honestly? But then we have this fragmented system. And that system is, although it's funded, they all require different funding. Robin, do you want to pick that up? That change in principles and values from those early pioneers to much more market-led system.
Yeah, we'd like you to hang on to this quote from Susan Isaacs, if you can, this idea of the aim of education to create people who are free in spirit and gifted and worthy and desirable and able to give and take freely, to engage. Next slide, please. Chris said that things were fragmented. They were indeed fragmented, geographically and in type. By the 80s, still the nursery schools were still able to demonstrate this engagement with children very dynamically. And these are some pictures from the spring of 1985 in the nursery school that I was working in at the time. These are my pictures. And you can see here an episode one springtime, and the children had been rolling some telegraph poles around that had been sitting around. And as they'd rolled the telegraph poles, some children saw the mini beasts underneath, but they also wanted to move them. And so with a good gang that we got together, we quite quickly constructed this climbing frame, which you can see here. And the picture on the right, you can see children beginning to explore it. As adults, we'd mostly stood back, although there's an adult working with one of the children with a hammer to take out some nails. And the other children are watching one another, learning to climb up. And you can see on the picture of the left, Stephen and his friend Stephen watching him as they're learning to jump off. So it's an example of adults acting intelligently, supporting children to become their best, to go beyond what's obvious. Thank you, Chris.
We haven't entirely lost it, but before 1989, those of us who worked with children in infants as they were then, what's now Key Stage 1, we had a freedom to decide what we wanted to teach. We knew we had to teach the 3 R's. We knew we had to get the kids to read and write. That was, you know, part of our mandate, really. But there was a freedom about it. And we chose the what. It wasn't prescribed until 1989, when we had the national curriculum, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But once we got into this, beginning to have a national curriculum, which was in many ways a backlash from what was considered progressive education, we started to get more documents in early years as well about exactly what it meant. And this is one of the early ones. This is quality and diversity in early learning. And if you can just tap on it, Gabriel, it will just focus on what it was about. Here you can see what it was about. We talked about belonging and connecting, making that connection between the children and their community, children and the natural world. We talked about contributing and participating and being active and expressing, thinking and imagining and understanding. And eventually we talked and talked and talked, but it didn't quite fit with the national curriculum subject areas. And so ultimately we lost this kind of value-based, very value-driven type of articulation of what we were about. And the first one that came in was desirable outcomes. And here we have, if we press it again, Gabriel, we'll find desirable outcomes. Now, there's a very subtle difference between the quality and diversity here and what we would like for children as to desirable outcomes, what we want it to be. And desirable outcomes actually began the slow process in early childhood of becoming much more prescriptive about what children had to be able to do or should be able to do by the time they finished foundation stage. Now, the national curriculum, in all fairness, was meant to make sure that everybody got a broad and balanced curriculum. It wasn't left to whichever school you went to actually decide what you got as part of your curriculum. And we started off with the big pink folders on every teacher's classroom shelf. And it has come down and down until it is now just one document. It is one whole through for Key Stage 1 and for Key Stage 2. But when we talk about broad and balanced, it is quite interesting if you look at what's being prescribed for us. Can you do the next slide, Gabriel, please? In this prescription, in the programmes of study, what we should be teaching to children, we end up with this balance. And I don't think anybody would probably object to the fact that we must teach English, we must teach maths, and we must have a focus on those things. But it's those little things. Art and design, 1.2%, I think it's 3 or 4 pages in this document. You get 70 pages of English in the document. You get 3 or 4 pages related to art and design. Little, about the same for all those other subjects. But even then, there's plenty of room for prescription. And we're now talking about the early childhood, the earliest foundation stage document, the latest iteration of that, actually being brought in line with the subjects of the national curriculum. And you find things like, in early years, they have to have books about historic people read to them. Then by Key Stage 1 at 6, they need, you can show the next one now, we can move on, Gabriel. Because at Key Stage 1, you get a 6-year-old who's being asked to compare the lives of and things to do with Christopher Columbus and Neil Armstrong. There's even one on Bruegel and Lowry, which is advocated. And by Key Stage 2, and they need to have then a chronologically secure knowledge. I'm quoting, a chronologically secure knowledge and understanding of British, local, and world history, and all before you're 11. There's also lots of other programs, though. We get programs of what we should teach and how we should teach it. And the classic one has to be phonics. We've all taught phonics. When I started teaching in the 1970s, I taught phonics. It's a particular knowledge and skill that children, it makes reading decoding rather than reading for understanding. But what we have seen over the years is more and more prescription. And now in Key Stage 1, phonics and reception is taught as systematic synthetic phonics. It's a phonics in a particular way. And we have accredited programs that schools are able to use to teach it. Those programs prescribe. They say which bits of phonics you're going to teach, what order you're going to teach it in, and how you're going to teach it in many ways, and the resources that you're using. If you add to this programs for maths or programs for physical, for personal, social, and emotional education, and for music, then children are spending a lot of time being given these programs with prescripted lessons, associated workbooks, and it makes them passive recipients of what we're offering. Passive recipients. Children's ideas, their hypotheses, their capacity for problem solving is being closed off by these number of programs. And you can see with Ofsted, the accountability systems emphasize their use. In the white paper, Ofsted has, even though Ofsted say that they don't actually dictate methodologies, the new white paper absolutely states that the Ofsted inspections of early years will always include a focused review of early reading, including systematic synthetic phonics, as the best way to teach children to read. It's critical to teach children to read, but children don't read by doing it in one way. The other way, of course, as well as I said, is the accountability we have through standardized assessment. Next slide, Gabriel, please. You'll see from the slide, this is just from year two to 10 or 11. So you're 2 years old through to 10 or 11, and you're going to have these things. It starts with a two-year-old check, and it ends up with your year six SATs, and you're constantly on the way through, checking whether you have learned what you are supposed to learn year on year. We also know from visiting schools that children actually are subject to lots of other tests in between to make sure that they're going to be able to do the tests, the standard ones, the SATs. So there'll be tests in between on milestones. There might be formal tests. Year six, they could be doing practice tests for the SATs, where we're constantly testing as if measuring what they can do will improve their learning, which it's not. The learning's happening somewhere else. What they are checking as well is that these children are ready for their next stage of education. Now, you might say, well, why shouldn't they be ready? Get them ready. We don't ever ask whether the school is ready for the children. We are pushing the children into being ready, and that readiness is measured on arbitrary measures, what people decide they ought to do. You've only to look at the changes that have been made to what children need to do in language and numeracy by the end of reception. And on the grammar tests for the year six SATs, I'm not sure there aren't quite a lot of people out there who wouldn't be able to do the year six SATs grammar. So we prepare children all the time for the next stage instead of valuing where they are. And to some extent, wherever you are in education, there are people who are doing other things. But with this level of prescription, a lot of people find to get through what needs to be got through, creativity and innovation are pushed to the side. We'll be talking next time about how this can still happen, so don't get too depressed. Robin, what about the consequences for teachers and educators in all this, though?
There was a sentence from Dewey that just came to mind, from John Dewey, who was working in America in the 1930s and so, and became quite unpopular by the likes of the Thatcher government by the 1980s. And he said, we must give up on the idea that education is a preparation for life. It should be seen as life itself. So instead of it being a preparation for, it's the quality of life itself, of young people, learners engaging now. But instead, we've seen that the government is valuing education as preparation, as instruction, and you tick the boxes when you achieve a certain skill, or not if you don't, and then you fail. And one of the consequences of the de-skilling of education is also the de-skilling of teachers, who are tasked simply to become technicians. They are not asked to be intelligent accompanists of children. They are technicians who should efficiently deliver. Ironically, at a time when there's a stronger expectation on schools to solve all of the society's ills, instead we can see growing staff stress, burnout, sad children. We can see among teachers, they've rather lost the idea of becoming intelligent professionals. They're under stress about that. And we all know young, very promising teachers who simply can't face it anymore and leave. We do need change, but we know that change in our fashion is not wanted by the purse holders in the government. Mick Waters and Tim Brickhouse, both of whom have led local authority education departments in the past in Manchester and Birmingham, have just recently put out a book about our schools, delineating this unhappy history and the power struggles that are going on now. And they say, lobby groups, interest groups, factions, researchers, practitioners, think tanks, and all manner of individuals try to nudge the school system in various directions. But the shift that gains most traction is usually government policy. And we do not have a public debate or idea or vision about education. And that's what we are here to begin to transform. Because there is resistance, that's why we're here. There are places where pedagogy is hanging on and is finding ways to stay more creative, innovative, and inspiring. And we will be talking, as Chris said, about those next time. Our roots and connections haven't been forgotten, but we need to turn the tide. Next slide, please. The tide is going to take a lot of pushing. It's been quite intentional, the change from the values that you've seen in documents that have come from the sector, such as quality and diversity, to the government-produced documents and outlooks. And this is a quote from Dominic Cummings, who was very instrumental in the 2010s and 2013s in the shape of changing education in its values and in the structures, in deconstructing and privatizing. And this is what he says: real talent among teachers is rare. Mediocrity is ubiquitous. While heads need to be flexible enough to allow talented people to experiment, we also need schools in chains that spread proven approaches and 90% solutions without relying on innovation, inspiration, and talent. They actually do not want professional educators. They want program deliverers, direct instruction in which teachers follow tightly constrained rules to deliver lessons is proven effective in randomized control trials around the world. Well, we've looked at that, and they're telling a lot, they're largely telling porkies to tell their own story. The story he tells of teachers is rather the story that he believes of children, that children are born talented, or most likely they're born mediocre. And since, according to them, most children are mediocre, what's the point of education which listens to children? So with that cheery note and lovely slide, I'm going to pass you to Madeline, who's going to talk about situation in secondary.
Thank you, Robin. I'm going to be a little bit speedy because I'm aware that there's needs to be time for questions. So just to focus on secondary, I'm sure that lots of people listening have experience personally with their children going through the secondary school system. I've seen some comments and they're not cheerful. I have kids going through it as well. And yes, it's can be a very grim experience. So GERM has found, unfortunately, very fertile ground in the secondary system. The same themes are emerging: standardization, privatization through academization, outsourcing of services, competition, not collaboration between schools, and people being dehumanized, teachers and children being dehumanized through constant measuring and removal from the production line, if you like, if they're deemed faulty. And of course, the worst excrescences of that are children being off-rolled to other schools within, say, a multi-academy trust, a number of academy schools, or at worst case, just being thrown out. I know that sounds very negative, but there's a little bit of a positive bit at the end, so wait for that, please. So my first slide, please, Gabriel, which is just to recap on the kind of purpose of education, which I think what this discussion really boils down to. And you can see here some of the reasons given for education over the years, over the centuries, some of which Peter and Chris and Robin have touched on. And unfortunately, the one that has particularly caught the government's eye is number one, which sounds quite innocuous and is a Matthew Arnold quote from the 19th century thinker. But in reality, passing on the best that has been thought and said becomes an exercise in knowledge recall. There's a little bit of number three thrown in, preparation for work, which we'll come on to later. But if I could just go to slide two now, please, Gabriel. So knowledge recall under this perception of learning would probably be in the first layer, as it were, disciplinary knowledge. This is a graph put together recently by the OECD in an attempt to try and summarize what learning looks like in its many elements. And although there's a little bit of social and emotional skills being encouraged now, which is the middle of the blue layer, that's not tested. The only bit that's actually tested at the moment is the top ninth, as it were. Everything is taught in subjects now. There's very little interdisciplinary knowledge. And of course, you'll know if you've got kids in secondary, there's almost no practical education at all now. And just going on to the next slide, what's interesting is to look back around 100 years and see that even in 1904, the core curriculum for secondary age students, although it would have been actually out to probably 14 then, is actually more broad than the curriculum in 2016, because we had technical drawing. I remember I went to a school that was basically a secondary modern that just become a comprehensive, and we had fantastic technical drawing facilities, we had amazing metalwork and woodwork. All that has gone now. So where does that leave us? On to the next slide, please. What that means is we have now an incredibly narrow academic curriculum. We've got rid of anything practical, we've got rid of a lot of the focus on arts and creativity because it can't be measured and it doesn't fit as much with this whole obsession with knowledge recall. We also have something called Progress 8 and Attainment 8, which Michael Gove came up with thanks to his spad Sam Friedman, who allegedly thought it up over a weekend because Michael Gove had to have something to say on a Monday morning. And essentially that means that schools are tested, assessed in 8 core subjects, none of which are art subjects. And Progress 8 measures how much progress students make from when they took SATs.
And the trouble with that is that SATs have been made incredibly hard by Michael Gove. He had this idea that if you make stuff hard, standards will rise. The same thing's happened with GCSEs, as any parent will know. So there's huge amounts of content to get through. And what that's done is it's basically a guarantee that a substantial number of students now fail and don't leave school with any significant qualifications. So this graph you see says it's 25%. There's various ways of quantifying that, but quite often people talk about the forgotten third, because we have this system now at GCSE called comparable outcomes. And I see there's lots of teachers joining who will know exactly what that is. So put very simply, what that means is that they'll look at how many people failed SATs in year six, and it is now pass or fail, and they'll impose those grade boundaries on GCSEs. So it means that every year you can guarantee a third of students will fail English GCSE and Maths GCSE, for example, which means they can't even get a job as a shelf stacker in the local Sainsbury's. So next slide, please. We have therefore created an underclass, because what's really important to look at is who is failing, which cohorts are failing, and at both SATs and GCSE, key groups are consistently failing, and they are kids growing up in poverty, students with additional needs who are neurodiverse, and students who have English as an additional language. And if you see on this graph here, you can see that the attainment gap, which the government used to talk about a lot, but weirdly has stopped talking about recently in the white paper that came out last week, you'll see that the gap was actually narrowing around about 2016, 2017. Then Michael Gove introduced his much harder GCSEs and they were rolled out across the board by 2018. And now you can see this really significant rise in the attainment gap. So poorer kids are doing much worse under this system. And of course, since the pandemic, it's gone right off the scale. So next slide, please. Oh no, sorry, go back again. Sorry, so we've got a bit of a gap now. I've got a bit of a slide gap, but I just wanted to throw in a few other key points, which I think the essence of it is this point about equality and equity. So you'll often hear the government say that exams are the fairest system, because, you know, in some senses, it's quite a clever argument. Everyone goes into the exam hall and they're all treated in the same way. But the key point is it fair? Because certain kids who perhaps have lots of difficulties and challenges at home, or have missed a lot of school because of that, or for whatever reason, or because they're simply bored by the curriculum, they're going to fall behind and they're going to do really badly. Now, somebody like Cummings might say, well, they're just not as gifted as the other students. And I think that graph from Robin, which really sums up the whole issue, suggests that that's probably how he sees things. And I think his belief in social mobility is about plucking out the minority of kids, possibly from a working class background, and shoving them towards Oxbridge and Russell Group universities. So it's a fairly depressing view, actually, of what students are capable of. And it doesn't acknowledge that kids, as any parent will know, have different capabilities. Some of them are academic, some of them less so, some of them a combination. So I just wanted to throw in a couple of other things. You might be sitting here thinking, if you don't have kids in secondary school, how do students put up with this dry, arid curriculum? And the answer is a lot of them don't, and they get chucked out because if they're not working, they're not going to deliver results, and the schools are going to get downgraded by Ofsted, because for whatever Ofsted says, essentially results are still a really important aspect of inspection. And for the ones that do stay, they are increasingly exposed to a kind of zero tolerance regime. Some schools, you're actually told you have to track the teacher, keep your eyes on the teacher. You can't take your eyes off the teacher, or you get told off, and worst case, you get stuck in detention. And so this kind of no excuses culture, which originated in the States and was pioneered by people like Michael Wilshaw at Mossbourne Academy, one of the earliest academies, has become really current, particularly in academies, particularly in schools in deprived areas, where it's obviously much harder to engage children in this very narrow, boring curriculum when they've got all sorts of other stuff going on in their lives. And finally, academisation. So as Peter mentioned, the continuing dogma from this government is about ensuring all schools become academies. There is no evidence that improves standards. In fact, I think there's an article that Gabriel's going to bring up here in the chat box, which was from Schools Week yesterday, from a very respected professor and academic, because there is so much research showing that changing structures doesn't improve the quality of education, which kind of is common sense, really. What's going to change it is better teaching, teachers more respected, paid better, better conditions, and tackling some of these broader issues around poverty, for example. Final insult is funding. So under the kind of GERM vision, it's obviously informed by kind of business practices, and it's about running efficient businesses, efficient schools. So it's kind of antithetical to GERM to think, do you know what, we're going to put loads of money into schools because we really believe in education. And interestingly, I was lucky enough to have a kind of a briefing from somebody who's very well informed on why the Treasury didn't come up with all the catch-up money that was asked for by Kevin Collins, which is £15 billion. And really interestingly and depressingly, the answer was the Treasury just do not see the point in investing in state education. They don't even see the economic point. And I think this goes back to the Cummings vision that most people aren't really capable of much. And so, you know, we just need an efficient delivery system. And anyone with any intelligence will either be in private schools or we'll pluck them out somehow because they're going to get great results. So that's a bit depressing. My next slide is the consequence, which we've sort of touched on. So, you know, 40% of teachers are leaving the profession within, I think it's 5 years. We know from earlier comments, there's hardly anybody studying the arts. The forgotten third, and then this is just one stat on 25% of teenage girls self-harming. But I mean, there was a piece in The Guardian yesterday reporting on how GPs say that many, many of the students that come to them, the young people that come to them as patients who are suicidal, are waiting up to 2 years to get support from the child and adolescent mental health service. So, you know, we have an epidemic of unhappy children, and we have no actual proper studies done on the causes of that, which is, I think, quite interesting in itself. But more and more charities are reporting that exam stress is what's triggering most of the unhappiness. So my next slide is about, so this is the irony. So we're constantly told by politicians that education is about preparing people for work. But actually the irony is for the last 10 years or so, outfits like the CBI and so forth have been saying, we want students, we want young people who can think, who can work in teams, who are critical thinkers, who have digital skills, and our extremely dull curriculum is not providing any of that, and it's costing the economy all this amount of money. Next slide, please. This is my final slide. This I'm trying to make out is a cheerful slide. It may not look like it, but I think this is how we can turn the situation around. Most parents, this is something from the Edge Foundation, a charity that does a lot of really good research, are not happy with the system. I feel that myself, having spoken to other parents. I think that we come out of the system being pretty underwhelmed. And so this is the chance to turn these parents, otherwise known as voters, towards an alternative system. And in fact, in my filmmaking role, I've just made a film about an amazing school, an amazing comprehensive in Doncaster called XP. And that film is coming out on the 5th of May. And the idea is that anybody can screen it, they can share it, and they can go and talk to their head teacher, whoever, and get something in the local paper to try and say, we need a better system. And this is a brilliant one. Why can't we do this? So if you follow the Edge Foundation or Rescue Our Schools, you can find out more. There's a toolkit. So I think the whole idea is to try and show alternatives, basically, in answer to the many questions, what can we do? Show great alternatives and say, we want this. Thank you. Question time.
Okay, I seem to have lost my video.
Question time. So sorry, Peter, it's your bit.
I'm nearly finished. My video seems to have been switched off for me, so I don't quite know why that is. So,
we switched your video off earlier on because you were breaking up quite a lot. So we were
Improving
the sound quality. You might be okay again now if you want to give it a go.
Okay, so to conclude, our argument tonight has been that GERM has been a failed neoliberal education experiment running from early childhood upwards with serious consequences for children, for teachers, for schools, and indeed for society as a whole. Next slide, please. Jervis led to a fragmented and confused system, messy and often confusing in the words of the white paper. It has brought about a narrow and impoverished education. It has reduced children to human capital, parents to consumers, teachers to technicians, and schools to exam factories. And GERM has killed off education as a democratic, collaborative practice within schools that are democratically accountable to their communities. And in its place is a centralized system of control in which the Secretary of State, sitting in Whitehall, is personally accountable for over 9,500 schools. And as Tim Brighouse points out, wields more than 2,500 powers over schools. Next slide. Last, but very much not least, GERM has undermined education's potential to be emancipatory, to be exciting, to be enjoyable, and to be enriching, as well as its potential to be a public good that engages creatively with the converging environmental, political, social, and economic crises of our times. For example, by renewing and strengthening democracy. And in a very excellent book written by Wilfred Carr and Anthony Hartnett called Education and the Struggle for Democracy, they say, any vision of education that takes democracy seriously cannot but be at odds with educational reforms which espouse the language and values of market forces and treat education as a commodity to be purchased and consumed. In short, today's education has made itself irrelevant to the huge challenges that we are facing as a society and indeed as a planet. Next slide, please. So GERM has failed, and so too has its parent neoliberalism, the condition that enabled GERM to thrive. Both are now in deep crisis. Adam Tooze, the historian, and I think one of the most astute commentators of the state we're in, has captured this sense of crisis and terminal decline. He writes, seeing 2020 and the pandemic as a comprehensive crisis of the neoliberal era helps us find our historical bearings. Seen in these terms, the coronavirus crisis marks the end of an arc whose origin is to be found in the 70s. Next slide. So, as you'll have gathered, today's session has mostly been bad news. So we want to end on a positive note. For crisis brings the prospect of good or better news for education, because crisis brings opportunities for transformation. That is, if we are ready. In the much quoted words of the economist Milton Friedman, the godfather of neoliberalism, when that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. GERM has caused mass historical amnesia, making us forget those past educational giants and those rich educational experiences that Robin and Chris reminded us of at the beginning of their presentation. But we can regain our memory and use it to develop alternatives. So more good news next time, because there are alternatives. Thank you for your attention.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much, Peter. And it was really good to hear you try to end on an uplifting note. And I think all of you managed to kind of weave in some optimism and hope and gesturing towards alternatives through all your presentations. So that was incredibly rich. Thank you. And so many different thoughts buzzing in my brain. And I can see from people in the chat that people are getting a lot out of this. And it's sparking, seems like a lot of recognition from a lot of the educators in the room as well. So it's certainly striking a chord. So now is the time for questions. I can see we've got a bunch already loaded up in the Q&A. As I said at the top of the call, hopefully it'll be okay for us to just call on some of the most popular questions. We'll be asking you to unmute yourself and then you can just click the the button and it should unmute you. But if you're having any trouble with that or prefer us to read out the question, we're happy to do that as well. Gabriel, do you have a couple of people in mind for the first couple of questions? Should I pick somebody out of the list?
If you'd like to pick someone out, Francis, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there was a couple who were very popular quite early on. I think we're going to go to the first question from Derry, which is a question around curriculum, responding to one of the slides from that we were talking through, I think, in relation to the curriculum. Have we got Derry there for?
Derry, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Sorry, I've unmuted. Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Would you like to put your question to the panel?
Oh, yes. Okay. One of my propositions is, for a start, because kids have so little choice and schools take so little awareness of the interests and knowledge and experiences and concerns and questions that the kids bring to school, I'm proposing, for a start, really, that 20% of curriculum time in all schools should be allocated to the concerns, purposes, questions, interests, passions of the pupils' students. Where I've seen this happen, the negotiation, I was an Ofsted inspector, I should say, for 10 years and inspected about 200 schools. And I saw this kind of thing beginning in some secondary schools where there are elective programmes. And the negotiation of this changes the nature of the relationship between young people and adults. The young people begin to feel that what they're bringing to school is taken seriously. And so young people and adults can work together in these concerns, questions, interests, passions, blah, blah, blah. And just organising how the school will set about doing this involves a lot of democratic and participative negotiation and decision making between the kids and the adults. And it just seems to me an obvious idea. The state still has 80% of the time, for God's sake. You know, how much does it want? Can't it allow some opportunity for the kids to develop agency and autonomy by taking control of part of the curriculum? So I'd like to throw that idea open for discussion and ask the panel what they think of it.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. I'll get a couple more questions in the first round and then go back to the panel for their responses. I wonder if I could ask, there was a very good question asked by Kimberly about the role of exams is something that most of the speakers touched on. Kimberly, I wonder if you are around to ask your question directly to the panel.
I am. Hi, thank you. I didn't know you could unmute yourself on a webinar, so I learned something new. So as you might tell from my voice, and I put it in the chat, I moved here from New York City during COVID. I will say I'm listening to this. My 14-year-old decided to stay in the US and go to a progressive boarding school for a lot of the reasons that we're all talking about here. But I went back to graduate school and I'm very interested in advocating for progressive education, which in New York City was a really interesting thing to do, or in America in general. I came here and I've obviously switched my thinking around what is possible here. And I was just having a meeting with somebody yesterday. And I think for me, the first biggest issue is that, I mean, I loved the last question. I would say 100% of the time should be given to the kids. That's how my kids got to go to school. It is incredibly powerful. They love school. They love going to school. They love learning. But you can't end that with an exam. And whenever I get to that part of my statement, everyone's heads explode. And so I guess my real issue is, are there any opportunities here? I've analyzed all the schools. I put together a database of people doing things that are different, trying to. There's some teeny little inserts into the process, but it seems the answer may really be no. And I guess that's where I get stuck. So right. I'd be really curious what everyone thinks about just, in particular, I heard someone say you need your GCSEs even for a kind of entry-level hourly job. Is that really true? I guess that's a question.
Yeah, the dominance of the cachet, the currency of exams and qualifications is something I think we have to address at the same time as exams. Thank you, Kimberly. I'm going to get one more question as this round. And I think sticking on the question of the curriculum, I wonder if I could ask Michael Sinclair to ask your question, because I think it fitted in really well with the previous two. Michael, I wonder if you're there. Brilliant. Everybody's so punctual tonight, popping up. I think if you want to unmute yourself, you can ask your question.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'll say this as briefly as possible. I was very fortunate in 1966 going to Dartington College of Arts. And this was part of three schools that were a progressive education based on self-supporting communities that were modelled on Rabindranath Tagore's system in India. I was only there for 2 years, but this was an incredible education that shaped my life. And I became an educator in several capacities later on. I taught in art school, I taught adult education, I taught children. And one of the concerns I have is that I don't think there is, I think we need a radical reform of social education at a very young age. If we don't have social education, which means leaving the subjects apart, teaching children how to be an individual within a group, we have all sorts of problems in our adult years later. We have many societal problems that lead from early age specialization in subjects. And, you know, I often have recourse to think about the polymath versus the specialist. I have grave doubts about specialism. And yet to achieve your subject, you need to have focus. And in some way, in having that focus, you need to narrow your parameters. Unfortunately, it can lead to problems. And I think we've seen this in the last 2 years. With the amount of disagreement between scientists. So the polymath is all important. The person that has, who's critically intelligent and aware of many issues. Are our schools delivering this? So that's one thing. It's a main concern of mine.
Brilliant. All right. Thanks so much, Michael. So we've had three great questions there from Derry, Kimberly and Michael. I'm just going to ask the panel to respond to any, which just pick out some questions that you want. Let's go to Madeline first and go sort of reverse order. We'll have another round as well. So.
Okay. Really good question. So in answer to Derry's point, I love the 20 Cent Project. I think it's fantastic. I would love to persuade my kids' school to do it. I think it's the hard thing is head teachers are so trapped mentally by the accountability system that it's just so difficult to get them to step aside and think of, you know, as you say, Derry, doing something relatively simple, which is just spending one day a week with the kids following their passions. I'm absolutely sure it would actually improve attainment across the board. Second point from Kimberly. Yes, I think you still do need GCSE maths and English, I'm afraid, to work in Sainsbury's, although perhaps Brexit has changed that slightly. But as far as I was aware, 2 years ago, you certainly did. In terms of the how to get rid of exams, some really interesting thinking is going on in this area. It actually started in the States, funnily enough, with something called the Mastery Transcript, which was started by a private school in Ohio. And essentially, the idea behind it is to have a learning profile. So instead of a series of exam results at 16 or 18, and of course, we're about the only country around that has a high-stakes exam also at 16, you get a very sophisticated digital profile of all your capabilities, whether it's critical thinking or altruism or some kind of philanthropy project you run in the community or an extended project. And that is all presented on one digital platform. And they've actually got Yale and Harvard to sign up for it. And the good news is there's a group in England called Rethinking Assessment, started by Peter Hyman, who is one of the few pioneers around at the moment of trying to do things differently with his School 21. And they are trying to develop something very similar. And interestingly, Cambridge University has become very interested in this model, which would not depend on A-levels. The other thing to mention is there is something called the London Interdisciplinary School, which launched a year ago, which takes students on even if they haven't got exam results. And it puts kids through a series of interviews, a series of challenges, and it's trying to move away from the exam system and offer a really interesting education, which is about trying to get students to solve global problems. So that's something to really look at, Kimberly, I would say. And finally, Michael's point. So I think that something to mention on social education is XP School, because they have this concept of crew, which is an American idea again, and actually before that has its origins in Kurt Hahn and Outward Bound. And the point behind it is to split up your average tutor group of 30 kids into about just 12 to 15 kids and create a kind of second family at school and really build those social connections. So they've got primary schools within their trust as well. So that's something that I think is really worth looking at. And as for polymath, well, I totally agree. I mean, basically, rethinking education is about getting rid of GCSEs and having a much broader qualification at 18, a bit like the baccalaureate and more like what most countries do. So there are some interesting things, and we can talk about those in the next session.
Brilliant. Thanks, Madeline. I'll come to Robin next, then we'll go Chris and Peter, and we'll reverse orders for the next round.
I've just been putting together thoughts about various comments and questions, and sort of beginning with Adam Hawley's thought about, is the onus on us? Well, I think definitely the onus is on us, because there's a dissonance. I'm about what's wanted. And going back to what Johnson, Imode and Deanne Garrett were asking and saying, Johnson said, what do we think of the statistics about children reaching key standards? Well, what do we think? Well, these key standards don't really mean very much to children. They suit a competitive government stay in power because they can lord their stats within Parliament. I don't think much of them at all, really, particularly when we see what they do to children. And Deanne also, thinking about research, we have this idea of objectivity and measuring still. And Deanne was asking, is there research to demonstrate the use of play and experiential learning? Well, yes, there is tons of it. There's tons of it going around every day internationally. But it doesn't matter two hoots to a statistically focused, obsessed government, unfortunately. We can demonstrate to the government till the cows come home. So coming back to Adam, I think the onus on us is on us to make a fuss and saying this is not good enough for us and our children. I'm dubious about the idea of a 2080 kind of idea. I've seen what happens in primary schools. Fairly recently, we were working on a project in many primary schools, and encouraging the educators to think differently about the potential for their children, taking the classes out into the woods, seeing the children engaging, and trying to show the adults a better way to work with their children's ideas. But those children were already being force-fed with programs such as, some of you will know it, Read, Write, Ink, and which is a phonics-type force-fed reading program. And they don't work together, because on the one hand, you have force-feeding children, which squishes them, and then on the other hand, you say, well, now you're free to think. It doesn't really work. We've got to fight for an intelligent education. And unfortunately, this goes back not just to the Tory party, but back to Labour, which Blair talked about education, education, education. He was thinking of training, training, training. Gordon Brown, following him very rapidly on, talked about education being important because it increased our global competitiveness. He was talking about economics, basically. So, yes, I think it is up to us. In the COVID times recently, the government talked about catching up children, not that had lost their friends, lost experience, and needed the time to become rounded and again, but to catch up on their training. So, there, I'm going to pass to Chris.
Thank you, Robin. And I was quite interested in that notion of children's interests. There's a lot of work being done in Australia by Helen Hedges about the use of children's interests in learning and the importance of children's interests in learning. And Helen Hedges talks about children's interests at different levels, immediate interests, you know, that kind of, oh, spontaneous, I'm interested in that, this just happened. It's the kind of children running to the window when it's snowing, instant interest. But also those bigger interests, that children have big interests because they're interested in big ideas. And sometimes when we're talking about choices, that we can study big ideas, they are interested. Children are interested in life and death, in their place in the world, understanding how these things work, big ideas that they could make choices within those big ideas as they explore the big ideas. I've worked in an international school where we did actually use PYP, and I have some reservations, lots of reservations about it, where they study big ideas about where they're, who they are, particularly, and what's their place in the world and how they fit into the world and how the world works. And I think learning can be brought together by researching some of these big ideas. And when you're talking about exams and SATs and things, we're talking then about a different kind of assessment system, a different way of assessing. Exams are just summary assessments, and we can assess children in different ways if we need to. We don't need to sit them down as small children and give them an exam as year two SATs. We can actually, in all fairness, with young children, with the earliest tests that we're talking about, I would challenge any teacher who told me they needed to do those tests in order to find out what their children knew. The vast majority of teachers, particularly of young children that I meet, know those children inside out, backwards and forwards in their everyday interactions. And so a test is absolutely ridiculous. So we could get rid of a lot of those tests without even thinking about it and trust the teachers. I once heard, I think it was Tiziana, I can't remember Tiziana's surname, from Reggio Emilia in Italy. There we go. Talking about, we need to trust the children, their desire to learn through their interests, through what comes to them and what can be presented to them, that trust the children to learn. Actually, it might not have been Tiziana, that might have been one of Carlin Rinaldi's phrases. But when we talk about children's interests, are hugely powerful. And I think it was Michael who was talking about social learning. When Robin and I at Sightlines, when we've worked with teachers, we're talking about children working together, children learning in relation to each other, through their relationships with each other and with the things around them and all kinds of other things. I think it's hugely important that we do social learning. Whenever people mention things like that to me, I think of Tom. Tom was an 11-year-old who was extremely bright, but working with anybody else brought him to tears. Why? Because he thought he was right and he didn't need to listen to anybody else. And I'm sure Tom is now hugely successful somewhere, but I'm not sure it's going to be in the social industry.
Great, thanks, Chris. And over to you, Peter.
Right. Well, I just, first of all, the idea of splitting curriculum on a 2080 or 3070 basis, I agree with Robin. It kind of doesn't really resolve the issue. I think it may be more interesting to think of curriculum being a continuum of curriculum, on the one end being totally prescriptive, setting down exactly what has to be learned and how it's got to be learned, and at the other end, it being a framework which actually sets very broad objectives and so forth, but leaves an enormous amount of room for local interpretation and local additions, and which also, I think, includes some very important statements of values. I'm very interested in the role of democracy in education. And it's striking that quite a number of countries, I'm thinking of, say, Sweden or Portugal, make democracy an absolutely central feature of their curriculum. whereas we don't really see it as figuring at all, which tells us something about also how we see the purpose of education. I think on exams, there's only one thing I would say. It seems to me the huge challenge is for us to understand and find ways of making visible what children can actually do, not to have tick boxes which tell us if they can do A, B, and C. Because actually, if you have a tick box, then you only look for A, B, and C. You don't see what children actually can do. And if we began to spend a fraction of the amount of resources that we spent on the whole massive examination and testing regime that we have today, if we'd spent a fraction of that on looking at other ways of understanding what children can do, then I'm sure we would have lots of very creative and interesting alternatives coming up. It's just that we've decided, for better or worse, to throw all our money on pursuing GERM, basically.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much, Peter. And I think you did touch on one of the questions, and I can see that Titus is very active in the chat around democracy, the links between democracy and education. I think we've got time for just one more question. And I was going to ask Eileen, because also you were very active in the chat and you asked a couple of questions, and one has been quite high on the list. About this, the first question you asked about the Scandinavian education system, I wondered if you wanted to come on to just quickly ask that question.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, I was a secondary school English teacher, but I did an A-level examiner, so I'm crazy about the academic substance of education, but I'm horrified in seeing the early years and having experienced my own children's early years at the over academic nature of it and how counterproductive it probably is. Since the Scandinavian education system, beginning formal education at the age of 7, has better results at 17. What do the panel think about radically giving our children back their childhoods? I have picked the last decade, I have had 4 grandchildren and I've been to primary schools, forbidden by my own children to speak to the teachers about my views. It just seems so counterproductive. They're given these children who are interested and curious, and then they're given this hefty academic stuff to do, which they could all do 2 years later if they were just left to play and develop happily. And a sense of failure that must be created in so many of them is tragic. What do the panel think about our chances of getting any government to consider making our school starting age a year, well, for me, 2 years later, and reducing the academic and giving good nursery education? I have spoken to various government Labour ministers at times about this, and they've said, oh, we don't want the more deprived families to slip further behind. But if there was tremendous nursery education, do the panel not think that could be avoided? And those children would have a chance to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a very powerful idea. So I'm just aware of time. Thank you for your question, Eileen. I'm going to ask the panel to just give a really brief closing comment, maybe picking up on Eileen's question, also because it was quite all-encompassing of the things we've been talking about this evening. And I'll go in reverse order of the questions last time. So over to you, Peter.
Well, we'll talk about, I think, the Scandinavian situation next time, because certainly in early childhood, it's absolutely exemplary. Children in Sweden and, in fact, the other Nordic countries do start school at 6. Used to be 7, it's come down to 6, but they go into a kindergarten class at 6. And I would say the important thing about those countries is that they're very successful, not only because of their education, but because they're much more equal societies. And actually expecting education to be a magic potion to sort out all the ills of the world is ridiculous. I think as Wilkinson and Pickett in their wonderful book, The Spirit Level, make it absolutely clear, if you want to be serious about the health of your country in a broader sense, then you need to address inequality first, and then education will follow on from that.
Although I guess there could be a virtuous circle there as well, because educational inequalities are obviously, as we know, interlinked. I think there is a section of the Spirit Level that talks about that. And also to just flag, the inner level, which is the follow-up to the Spirit Level, is excellent on that. And I think is also going into that in quite a bit of detail about the implications of that for mental health. I'm forgetting the order here exactly, but I think it was Robin, Chris, sorry.
I'm going to grab this from Robin. I'm going to have my say on this one. I think Eileen, you're absolutely right. I think that we have lost the notion, and historically the notion of early years has been squashed down and down and down. When I first started teaching in the 1970s, we had a theory of early years as being 0 to 8. And then the national curriculum kind of grabbed year 1 and 2 from us almost and pushed it down that line. And in many ways, early years has been sold down the river, increasingly grabbing it, that push down status. And we really do need to push back. And certainly in Wales, they were trying to do that with extending their foundation stage through to 7. But we do need to get a much more well-established early years practice, if you like, through, instead of foundation stage being having the push down and the insistence that they need to do this. That the most horrific thing I've seen was my youngest grandson who came home from his nursery with a phonic colouring sheet. And he was 3 last week. That kind of push down of expectations. We've actually got to show what is right for children and fight for it more, without doubt. And as for pushing that play-based provision higher up into the schools, we just have to keep trying and working with people to get it.
Brilliant. Thank you, Chris. Robin, over to you.
I would say that, well, I know that many of us have been advocating directly to politicians at different levels for many, many years. Some people have spent their working lifetimes doing that along with the day job. And up to now, we've seen that, to quote their quote, it doesn't work. And that leadership needs to be much more popular. Peter said the difference, talking about Finland, what they have there is a much more civically engaged population and outlook on what society comprises. We need to take the flag back and do it ourselves. We cannot rely on convincing politicians to change their minds because they're scared and preoccupied by their own power status, as we have found. So I think it's up to us. It's not up to us just as teachers. It's up to teachers with parents, with popular movements, informing ourselves, reconnecting, and that's for next time.
Yes, absolutely. Teachers as well. And finally, Madeline, a final thought for this session.
Well, I just think there's so much that needs changing. The system is so consistently broken that it's really, you know, knowing how to pick your battles. And I personally don't think that starting school later, even though I agree with it, is something that we would get traction on, sorry to say. But I do think, you know, Labour have consistently shown that they believe in investing in the early years. And interestingly, I was hearing the other day that when the white paper was being formulated, there was very, very little discussion of the early years. It just doesn't seem to be on the DfE, the Department for Education's radar under our current political regime. But, you know, you've got to be hopeful. I mean, from the lot of campaigning that I do, what we were learning the other day was that if people write to their MPs about certain issues, and then campaigners such as myself and other people like Rethinking Assessment then pinpoint those and then approach certain MPs or across the board, they're discovering that they'll get much more of a hearing if constituents have written to them. They're, you know, that pricks up their ears. So it's really about coordinating the, you know, these two levels between campaigners and professionals trying to influence policy and parents writing to MPs at grassroots, because the MPs are only going to shift on it if they think there's votes in it. And there is such an opportunity for Labour, I do feel, to articulate, you know, a really easily grasped vision of education, which is that not all kids are academic, you know, they've got all sorts of capabilities, and we need a system that reflects that, and it gives them the opportunity to explore all sorts of different passions. And I'm just hoping that Labour are going to do it, because I think the Greens and the Lib Dems have actually got some really good policies on education.
End note around the Progressive Alliance, which is also the sort of thing that Compass ultimately works on to try and make that and that happen. And it's a progressive alliance of ideas as much as it is
a consensus. Yeah,
absolutely. So thank you so much to the folks here tonight. I know that we're 1 minute overrun, and I'm sorry about that. At school, the biggest thing my parents and my teachers complained about was my punctuality. But we are only 2 minutes overrunning, and I really, really think that tonight's discussion has been incredibly rich and fruitful and thrown up a lot of questions, but also gestured towards those answers already in tonight's session. So a huge thanks to our panel, Madeline, Chris, Robin and Peter, for such varied and rich insights and left us all with a lot of sobering things to think about. But also, as we've talked about, you know, we also had this sense of what a good education can look and feel like, and what importantly that means for people's lives and a good society in a deep way. And politicians shouldn't be scared of talking about that in its sort of most passionate and inspiring ways. Everybody, the thing I always think is, everybody can think of a teacher who changed their life. Pretty much everybody you can speak to and know exactly how they changed their life and why. And if we are also supporting teachers to be doing that amazing work, how can we also have an educational policy which speaks to that, which gives them the space and freedom and creativity that we've heard from our speakers tonight? So don't despair. The second session is going to, of which we're going to look at solutions, is going to be on the 19th of May. The details of that are going to be available very soon, and you will all get an invite to your email account, everybody who signed up tonight. And we will also email up those resources that we spoke to on the slide as well. A huge, huge thanks to our panelists. A thank you to my colleague Gabriel for being excellent on the slides and for working with the tech so effectively and efficiently. And we really hope you can all make it on the 19th of May. Put that date in your diaries at the same time, and we will send you the link. Thanks very much for joining us here tonight, and good night, folks.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at compass office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.